Thank you. Thanks very much. You know, it's always nice for a speaker when people are clapping at the beginning of the talk. Just want you to know that. I'm going to do a session with you this morning I think you're going to like. In fact, I want to talk to you about it and get feedback even afterwards during break time. I'm calling it a new kind of leader. You know, it was back in the 1980s that the Soviet Union set a goal in their space program. They determined that they were going to send a cosmonaut up into space for 4 solid months in a shuttle. And at that point, for them, that was a big deal. They prepared a cosmonaut by the name of Sergei Kerflin. Sergei went through all the routines and preparations to spend 4 solid months in a shuttle. And, of course, they sent him up with all the preparations and food just in case anything went wrong. Well, something did go wrong. In fact, I think I'm safe in saying this morning that while Sergei Kerflin was up in space, his worst nightmare was realized. You see, he was up in space when his country went out of business. Do you remember those days back in the late 80s? That's a wrong place to be on the other end of a long tether in space, you know? The guys at the control center have left their post. They're out picketing in Moscow and driving tanks around. He's up in space. Hello, hello, hello. No one's there. 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 7, 8, 9. Finally, after 10 months in space, Sergei Kerflin is still up there. The guys return to the control center and bring the man back in. And oh my goodness, has his world been rocked? You remember these days, don't you? The Soviet Union is out. The Commonwealth of Independent States is in. Mikhail Gorbachev is out. Boris Yeltsin is in. And Sergei Kerflin's salary, which was once in the 95th percentile of Soviet salaries, the money he had now in hand could barely buy a Big Mac at the Moscow McDonald's. Oh my goodness, the times are changing. Now, I share that with you because don't you feel like I do sometimes where you get up in the morning, you're ready to leave the church, and you're thinking, someone changed the rules. Where are these people from? Do you ever feel that way? I've talked to some of you this morning. You've moved to another place and you're thinking, this is a new world I'm in. It's a new planet. It's a new culture. You don't know whether to slap the people or hug them, you know? It's just a new world out there. I don't need to tell you the culture in which we live is more dynamic now than it ever has been. I remember hearing a news report this last summer, and a man had been in a horrible automobile accident back in 1984. They had kept him alive. He was in a coma for 19 years. He came out of it last year. And the commentators were thrilled and celebrating at the family bringing this man back, but they said his wife was spending days just catching him up on what had happened. You know, I mean, that was the Reagan days. And yeah, I mean, you know, just change is in the wind. Now, you and I both worship a God that is unchanging. Thank God. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. But what makes us relevant is for us to have a Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other. Karl Barth first said that. Every Christian ought to have a Bible in one hand. I know what God has to say, but I have a newspaper that I know what's happening in the culture. I know how to connect with the culture in a relevant way. My question for you, and I'm just asking rhetorically right now, do you connect with your culture in a relevant way? No one exemplifies this better than the Lord Jesus himself, who was God incarnate, but who came at a time in world history where he couldn't just tap a button and send an email out to 6.3 billion people saying, I'm Lord, worship me. But instead, he comes at a time where he has to get face-to-face with people. And living in an agricultural place, he says, the kingdom of God is like a seed. It's like a bird. It's like a mountain. It's like a tree. And he took the very culture they were living in, and he connected them to it. He connected them to the timeless truths. You and I live in a fundamentally different world. I think about that man in the coma, 1984. Change has happened the last 19 years. Wouldn't you agree? Some of you were in ministry back then. I was in ministry back then. We live in a different world than what it was like back then. In fact, I was thinking this last year. You know you're in a whole other world when the number one rapper in the music industry is white. The number one golfer is black. Tallest player in the NBA is Chinese. Go figure. The short ones, you know? The America's Cup belongs to the Swedes, of all people. And just up to this last year, Russia and China were lobbying for peace. And the French think we're arrogant. Now, we're living in a whole other world, I want you to know. Now, This morning, what I'd like to do is take you on a journey. Because what I'm seeing as I train leaders and as I try to lead in different organizations, and as I just watch what the Spirit of God is doing, I'm thinking that I'm seeing a new kind of leader that God is raising up. Not in substance, not new in substance. The substance has always been the same. Amen? We've always cherished leaders who were men and women of integrity and character, who want to serve, who have a vision. That's the unchanging part. But in style and the way they connect with the people that's around them, because the people in the culture are changing. Hello? In fact, in one of the books I wrote a couple years ago, Nurturing the Leader Within Your Child, I talk about parents connecting with their kids' generation. I offer a definition for relevance. Let me just put this out in your head and let it simmer on the back burner. My definition for relevance is using what is cultural to say what is timeless. Using what is cultural to say what is timeless. And again, Jesus did this beautifully 2,000 years ago. And if you'll mark all the great leaders through history who have seen a movement, not just a moment, happen, it's been because they've been able to connect so relevantly with the people that needed to be led at that time. And they took them on a journey to a place they needed to be. But they started where they were. You don't just say, well, come in, bless God, and get full of the Holy Ghost, and once you get all set. You know, it's not that. It's not learning the subculture's language, folks. It's going where they are and taking them across the bridge, where they do get the deal. So the challenge in front of us is starting where they are and using what is cultural to say what is timeless, taking them to a new place. I just thought, I'll tell you what, I've got in my hand right here a bottle of water that I'm drinking this morning. This bottle of water is a great example, I think, of both the cultural and the timeless. Isn't it? Now, the water inside the bottle is the timeless part. Civilizations down through history have always needed water. The container it's in here, this little bottle of water part, is, and by the way, there's 40 different brands of bottled water today. I think we have enough options. Is there really that much difference? I don't think so. But the bottle that this thing is in is cultural. We have all kinds of different cultural bottles. The ancient Egyptians didn't use this container to pour water from. So watch this now. What we've done through history is we've found new containers to deliver the water to the people. Hello. And our predisposition is say, well, bless God, I learned how to lead under the pastor, led me to Christ back in 1974. That's the way I'm going to do it. Well, if that's where you're going to do it, you have a small crowd. I said, if that's where you're going to do it, you're going to have a small crowd. Just want you to know, just want to prepare you. It'll be small group ministry. One. Okay? I'm just being honest with you. Folks, we have the water. We do, don't we? And the key is to take this thing and find a container that they'll drink from, whether it's our kids or whether it's the people that we have in our the community around us, and change the pitcher. Don't baptize the pitcher. Carry the water. So, with this new kind of leader, here's my question I've been asking. As I look at churches, as I look at corporate cultures, as I look at political organizations across the country, we're going to be in every continent of the globe with Equip. What I've noticed is there seems to be springing up in every one of these environments this new kind of leader that seems to be able to connect and lead very, very effectively. And it's not just a power trip. It's not just a boss. In fact, it's not a boss. Sometimes it's a person that has no positional power, but personal power in their life. And what I'd like to do is take a few minutes. I think this will be a fun ride this morning. I want to walk you through not all of history, not leadership down through the ages, but let's just take the last 50 years. How has leadership been acceptable? How has leadership been given over the last 50 years? What I'd like you to do is take this journey with me, jot down a few notes, and then we're going to camp out at the final one where I think God is raising up a new kind of leader here at the dawn of the 21st century. Now, I want to make some leadership style statements before we jump any further in these notes. Leadership style statements. I'm going to try to do this PowerPoint here. Statement number one. There is not just one right way to lead. And all God's people said, okay. Isn't that nice, though? I tell you what, 30 to 40 years ago, the major universities that study leadership in America, schools like MIT and Ohio State and Michigan, they were saying, well, if you're going to be an effective leader, you've got to have a certain personality and style. And, you know, they kind of buttonholed. It was type A driven. It's just the opposite today. If there are 150 leaders in the room today, there are 150 different ways and different makeups and mixes. And that's just wonderful. You don't have to fundamentally change who you are to lead effectively. Isn't that cool? Number two, great leaders will change styles, but not principles. You'll find what will connect the people, and you'll change your style. Because the people are what you're after. Not just, well, they can find me. It's you finding them. And then number three, and this may be most paramount here, lasting leaders determine their style by observing their people. I didn't say you determine your substance. You determine substance by the living God. But your style, the way you're connecting. You're reading the people before you're leading the people. All right? Now, with that said, what I believe is that each of these different styles that I've noticed over the last 50 years or so is a response to the culture they were living in at the time. In other words, great leaders see the environment that they're in, and they're able to connect with it. So at the top of the next page, I think it's the top of the next page of your notes, I have a little timeline. I'm going to lay them out very quickly right now, and then we're going to go back and kind of unpack them over the next several minutes. The first style that I want to cover is the military commander style. You see that on the timeline simply there, okay? That was way back in the 1950s, and probably beyond. Probably the first half of the 21st century, the style that we embraced and accepted, it was just okay, it was popular, was the military commander style. By the 1960s and 70s, it seemed like the new kind of style was the leader is the CEO. By about 1980, it looked like there was a new style of leader emerging, and I'm going to call that the leader as an entrepreneur. I'll explain that a little bit. By about 1990, you see how change is happening more quickly as time goes on? It was a leader as a coach. And I believe now, as we move further into the 21st century, the two metaphors I'm choosing to describe this new kind of leader, and by the way, ladies, it's males and females that are doing this very effectively, is the leader as a poet gardener. The leader as a poet gardener. Okay, now this is I, Paul, not the Lord, but let's just move into this and I'll kind of unpack it with you, okay? The first style is the military commander. The military commander. Now, let me tell you why I chose this. You all, I'm sure, have been in a corporation as an employee or perhaps been in churches as you were growing up where it was a military commander style leading it. Can you identify with that? Okay? You're probably thinking of names and faces right now. You're thinking of saluting that person as you were following them, okay? This style is very, very... In fact, even today, you still see some military commander styles. This is a very top-down style. You hope to God they're benevolent and spirit-filled, but it's a very top-down... You know, there's one man at the top of that flow chart, and the rest of us are followers. In fact, you've seen the flow chart, haven't you? There's one box at the top, and the rest are a bunch of followers. And even though it may be called team, it's not team. There's one guy that's really the influencer, and we all kind of, if he says so, well, we do it. Okay? It's not funny. Okay? Now, I know, you either laugh or cry, one of the two, okay? Now, there are good military commander styles, but this is the thing that was very, very, very much in vogue back in the 1950s. If you think about it, back then, you didn't really question authority like we do today. That was the most high reverend in the pulpit, and you know, you did whatever he said. Listen, even in politics, our presidents at that time came from military backgrounds. Dwight Eisenhower, 2 terms. John F. Kennedy, 1 term. It was, you know, just salute that man and do what he says. Don't question the authority. And he came across like he had all the answers. If he didn't, he'd never admit it. It was strength. It's my dad's generation, just strength.
Put her there, buddy.
You know, that sort of thing. You know, it was no embrace. It was just put her there. You know, that sort of thing. That was kind of the style. Now, the key value, I'm going to say, was loyalty. This leader valued loyalty. You stayed loyal to that denomination. Hallelujah. You worked in a factory. You stayed there 40 years and got a gold watch. And then you retired. You stayed in one place. Isn't that true? Most of the time, it was just... Now, by the way, wouldn't you agree these days are gone? You'd just like to assume if they were Southern Baptists or this or that, they'd stay all the way. They'll change. We were opportunists in our day, and you know that. So the military commander, it was top-down. You didn't question it. It was flow charts. And whether it was a pastor or president, politician or whatever, they enjoyed the respect of the people and just pretty much followed. One reason I think this style was pretty predominant back then, if you think about it, education levels were lower. I spoke to my dad about this thought, and he said, Tim, you know, he said, I grew up on a farm in Indiana, and 8th grade education was normal. I mean, that's where you stopped, and then you worked on the farm. And so you look to the pastor or the leader or the president for all the information. People needed leaders for information. Do you realize we're living in the first generation that does not require a leader to get information? They go to the internet, and they can look up. They may research it more, know more than you do. You ever find that true on Sunday morning? Someone said, oh, and they come up with after the message and correct you and... How'd you know that? Well, I read 3 websites and studied 14, you know, online thing, whatever. And so we're in a new day. But this was the style 50 years ago. The next style that came along was what I'm going to call the CEO style. And now this is the name of a style. This is just one I've chosen. But the CEO style emerged by the mid to late 60s, early 70s. I would say 65 to 75, this is the style that was thrust upon us. And let me tell you why I think it happened. There's probably a million reasons, but I'm going to give you one or two real quick. Do you remember the 60s? Well, if you were there, you probably don't remember them. Do you remember reading about the 60s? In the 1960s, it was a decade of great... Yeah, you're just a little slower in here today. I want you to know that. Yeah, that's right. Thank God it's a new day. Back in the 60s, change was in the wind. University campuses were places of riots and picketing and demonstrations and in politics, the civil rights, everything. It was a time of great turmoil and change. And within this day of turmoil and change, a couple of things happened that I think caused the American people pretty much to put up a quiet but very real wall toward the military commander style, this blind submission to a leader. First of all, Lyndon B. Johnson, President of the United States, who was leading us in the Vietnam War, wasn't being completely honest with us about the war. In fact, by 1965, he had pretty much made up his mind he was not going to be able to win the war the way we were fighting it. But they kept on getting on the air and saying, things are fine, things are fine, things are fine. And they weren't fine. And by the late 60s, when we figured out things weren't fine, they were thinking, what else are you lying to us about, Washington? Add on top of that, Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal. Now you had a Democrat and a Republican, both not being completely honest. And there was this front that went up that said, we are not blindly following any more leader. This is a new day now. And I believe in the church as well as the corporate America, a new kind or new style of leader had to emerge that did not assume people were just going to blindly follow the leader. And I'm calling the CEO style this style because, like a chief executive officer, among other executives, there was this feel of, let me cast a vision, a clear and compelling vision, that hopefully you'll buy into and take the journey with me because you bought into the vision. Even if you don't like everything I do and say, and am, you'll go with me because of the vision. Does this make sense? And we have seen this prevalent. In fact, many of you have fallen under leaders who are CEO style. I'm going to cast a vision, you're going to get excited about the vision, and take the journey with me. The key value of the CEO style was productivity. This leader absolutely celebrated productivity. If we were to work in a factory and our job was to make widgets, our goal was to make more and better widgets. Enterprises were going nationwide. Marketing and franchising was huge. McDonald's took off. You know, that's that whole thing. So, and we first started hearing about the megachurch. A little place called Willow Creek Community Church emerged in the 1970s. And so this whole thing, church, corporate, politics, this new kind of leader seemed to break on the scene who said, let's be productive. In the churches, you know what was big then? Bus ministry. Bus ministry. We're going to get a billion gazillion kids in here from the buses. No, nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that was all part of the feel of the day. CEO style. Now, there's no special date, but right around the turn of the decade, right around 1980, a new style was emerging. And I'm going to call this new style the leader as an entrepreneur. The leader as an entrepreneur. The reason I think this new kind of leader was birthed in the 80s is because, think about the 80s. Remember that decade? It was a decade of great newness. There was great innovation happening. In fact, if you don't mind, take a minute and talk back to me. Think of some of the new inventions, innovations, new products that entered the marketplace in the 1980s. What were some of the new ones? Help. What's that? Cell phone. Computer. PCs. Cell phones. Yeah. Fax machine. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Lots and lots of Walkmans came in the 1980s. Lots of new innovations. And so what we did was we began to celebrate the leader that was going to be on the cutting edge. The term cutting edge, which we use every day today, that was the term that was birthed in the 1980s. We want to be on the cutting edge. Have you heard that term one too many times? Okay. Innovation, newness. And we put up a leader that maybe was messy, but we put up with a messiness because that leader was on the cutting edge. Innovation. We're doing new things. We're the first one to do it. And by the way, churches got bit by this bug too, didn't they? Be the first one to do it. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but there's a feel, there's a cultural sense that we're products of. Yes, we're followers of Jesus, but we're also products of the culture, like it or not. And so we're bit by this bug. And the 80s was a time of innovation, creativity, okay? And again, messiness in the leadership, but it was okay. We were going to manage by walking around, as Tom Peters said it. We're going to just kind of be fluid and dynamic and somehow figure it out as we go, because change is happening quickly. By around 1990, it seemed like a new kind of leader was emerging on the scene. And I'm going to call this the leader as a coach. The leader is a coach. This style became big for a number of reasons. Let me offer one. By 1990, what generation had become adults and had now entered the workforce in great force? Gen X. And the baby busters, or Gen X, had entered the workforce, and they were looking for authenticity. They would rather have a genuine leader than a great leader that would live in an ivory tower. They wanted to have someone that was touchable. They wanted a relationship. They wanted it at home, in their broken home, and they wanted it on the workplace too. And so the leader decided that he or she had to be more of a coach, where they had built some relationships, and they were brokers of the talents and players on that team. In fact, the key value was teamwork. We're going to build a team. Remember starting to hear this in the 90s? In fact, go into most bookstores today in the business or leadership section. You'll find a gazillion books on teamwork and coaching, teamwork and coaching, teamwork and coaching. It's the hot button today. In fact, work environments back in the 90s started creating environments and offices that were very conducive to relationship. They'd have sofas and coffee houses and, you know, you're thinking, what is this, a workplace or a, you know, amusement park, you know? And yet they wanted to create one, something that was conducive to a relational environment so they could keep the employees there. It wasn't just this cold, sterile factory anymore over on the west side. It was this work environment where there was video and sofas and you know the scene. That was the 90s. And by the way, that style still lingers as fairly contemporary to this day. But I'm going to suggest this morning that we're on the brink of a new kind of leader that God, I believe, the Spirit of God is raising up in this day. And I'm calling this new kind of leader a poet gardener, as I mentioned before. A poet gardener. Now let me do my best to take a few minutes and try to unpack what I mean as I describe this new kind of leader. I love the word poet, and I use this term first because this new kind of leader does not enter their ministry or their job or their organization claiming to have all the answers. They realize you're stupid if you think one person has all the answers. By the way, can you say amen to that? Amen. It's ridiculous for us to put on this front, this false plastic front that says, well, I've got all the, just come to me, brother, I'll tell you. One leader doesn't have all the answers. So they come into a work environment knowing they don't have all the answers, and they form leadership teams around them, not just teams of players, teams of leaders. More and more I'm seeing in corporate and churches and political environments, teams of leaders that have diverse skills, diverse contribution, shared values, but diverse contribution. In other words, we all value the same thing, we all work toward the same vision, but we bring different contributions to the table. And this poet leader is listening to the words, to the input. They're discerning, they're synthesizing, they're extrapolating Nancy and Bob's and Susan's response, and they're putting them together, and they're a wordsmith. They're able to extrapolate and synthesize and then put words to the vision that the Spirit of God seems to be saying to the entire team. The best answer may not have come from any one mind, including theirs. Now, that would never happen under a military commander. Military commander, very commonly, not all the time, but very commonly, if the idea didn't come from their brain, well, forget it. It's got to come from their brain. In fact, you found out ways to make it look like it was their idea. Remember this? Remember these days? A healthy poet gardener. I call him a poet or her a poet because they're listening to the culture around them, extrapolating, synthesizing, and then putting words to the idea or the vision of where we're going. The reason I use the word poet is, do you remember the last time you read a good poem? It may have been a while. But the last time I read a good poem, I came away thinking, man, that was great. And the reason I thought it was great was because that person was able to put into words the very thing I was feeling and thinking. They were students of the culture. I said they were students of the culture. And so this poet, it may not have come out all from his brain or her brain, but they're able to pull and put words to it, and everyone has this divine sense of, yes, that's what we need to do. Thank you for saying it. In fact, many people think it was your idea. But the point was, you were a student of many, many, the body, if you will. Now, let me tell you why you chose the word gardener. This is an equally powerful metaphor, I think. In the same way that a gardener tends to his or her garden and sees their chief job is to grow the plants in that garden, pull the weeds, fertilize the plant, water, photosynthesis, all that good stuff until the plant's growing, the gardener leader sees his or her primary job as developing or growing the people under his care. He is a people developer. Not just preaching at them, but mentoring, developing, growing the people. And this leader elicits the very loyalty that the military commander was really after and demanding 50 years earlier by earning it through a mentoring relationship. So So this poet gardener, this wordsmith mentor, is this wonderful leader that I believe people, even though they don't know quite what to call it, are looking for as a style. Now remember, I said substance doesn't change. Style is changing. I remember reading a number of books this last year, and one of the books I read that was fascinating to me was a book called It's Your Ship by Captain Michael Abershoff. It's a great guy, Navy captain in the Pacific Ocean. This book talks about the turnaround that happened on his ship. He was given the worst performing ship in the Pacific Ocean in the U.S. Navy. Thank you very much for that job. Within 6 to 8 months, I think, well, for sure it was 8 months, he had the best performing ship in the Navy. Of course, everybody else was coming after him saying, what have you done? What are you doing? What are you just demanding more of your soldiers? What are you doing? He said, no, no, no. And he didn't call it poet gardener, but as he begins to lay this out in this book, immediately it came to my mind, this is a poet gardener. Now get this, in a military environment, got the picture? Where it's pretty much top down. I'm the captain, you're not, okay? I don't know what you are, but you're not the captain, okay? In a military environment, the first thing he did was he began to sit down one-on-one with all the sailors on a ship. He learned their names, their families, their dogs. He just learned all about them. Began to address them, knowing that background among them. And then he started forming teams that would work together to solve problems on the ship. Rather than just saying, here's my order, they'd form teams because they were on the front lines. They knew what needed to be done. In fact, one great story he tells in the book is he was walking on the deck one day, and all the guys were out painting the side of the ship, which they did 4 times a year. Because it would rust so quickly. And when he looked down at one of the sailors, he said, how you doing? And the sailor said, permission to be honest, sir? You know you're in trouble when they say permission to be honest. He said, well, sure. And the sailor came up and said, sir, has the Navy ever heard of stainless steel? He said, well, what do you mean? And he started describing how this thing was rusting. He said, there's bolts you can get that won't rust. And so he put them on a task force and started a team and so forth. And within a few months, they were using completely different nuts and bolts on this ship. Now they paint it once a year just because they ought to, but they don't have to. They celebrate after victories like that. They have steak dinners he'll bring in and so forth and so on. And I'm telling you, the sailors don't want to leave his care. Well, I imagine not. He's a poet gardener. He's not this captain type that salute me and, you know, stay out of my way and so forth. There's this connection that's happening. And I'm suggesting if you have any hope of reaching the culture around you, I'm not talking about the church culture, the world that you're living in that you say you want to reach with a Great Commission. I'm thinking we can't just be military commanders going out and saying, you call me the Most High Reverend, please. Now, I give you lots of copy to read here. I'm going to allow you to just kind of read this on your own. But let me just summarize this way. They're students of the culture. They're wordsmiths. They synthesize ideas. If you look at the next page, I begin to lay out for you some characteristics of a poet gardener. Because of time, let me jump right into this. I'm going to give you maybe a handful of phrases that I think are good descriptions of this new kind of leader that God's raising up. See if these don't make sense to you. I'm sorry, the key value for poet gardener was connection and growth, okay? All right, characteristics of a poet gardener. Letter A, they're more highly relational. They see the need of the day is for relationships. Now, people have always needed relationships, but wouldn't you say that's on the forefront of their minds? They want someone they can connect with. Okay? In fact, I don't know if you feel like you're a people person or you're a highly relational person, but I'm going to just exhort you and challenge you as a friend to friend. You've got to begin to learn relationships. Somewhere along the leadership journey, you're going to say, Lord, help me to love these people and know how to communicate this love to these people. You may be cerebral. You may be a techie type. I don't know what you are, but you're going to have to learn to connect with people. Because this kind of leader is more highly relational. Okay? Letter B, they interpret culture and reflect well. You may have a predisposition to action and a bias for action. That's good. But listen, you're going to have to push the pause button and be patient. Because this kind of leader is listening and reflecting and interpreting the culture well. And they're thinking with their team, if you will, before they just say, this is what we're going to do. Okay? I'm a doer. I'm predisposed to just say, let's just take action. Ready, fire, aim. You know, that sort of thing. And I'm saying this person's much more, let's take some time to aim and do it right. Okay? Any other ready, fire, aim people in this room? Yeah. We're killing several people along the way, but we're saving some too. We're glad about it. Okay? Letter C, they're emotionally secure. Now keep in mind, I'm giving you the profile of a healthy poet gardener. I believe the poet gardener is emotionally secure. In fact, I'm going to say this, they have to be emotionally secure. Talk to me. Somebody raise your hand and tell me, why would the Poet Gardener leadership style require you to be secure emotionally? Anybody want to venture a guess? Yeah, they're so empowering. They're letting power go. And listen, if you enlist the comments of others, don't you think some of them are going to be criticisms? Yeah. Do we have testimonies in the room today? Absolutely. And so listen, you just have to say, it's okay, I'm welcoming this. I want to hear, I want to sift through this and come up with what I think God is saying, but I want to hear your hearts. By the way, people support what they help create. If they can be a part of the creation, they're much more apt to jump on board. So this Poet Gardener is letting them help create it. But you're listening, you're interpreting well, you're reflecting well. Letter D, sharing ownership freely. This leader shares ownership freely. In fact, they give ownership away. They're prone to say, rather than hold on to it and cling to it and say, oh, this is my church, they're saying, no, take this ministry. This is yours. In fact, see me, or if you need help, or let me coach you once a month. But they're freely sharing the ownership of this thing. Letter E, they empower others well. We commented on that previously. They empower others very well. By the way, the word empowerment is kind of a vogue term today. We talk about empowerment everywhere we go. You know, I define it very simply. When you empower someone, you're simply giving your power away. You're not clinging to it, but you're freely sharing it with others. Now, some of you are in churches right now where your eyebrow was just raised. You're thinking, I don't dare give that power away. You're going to have to learn. You have to learn to build trust, and eventually you're going to learn that if you want to build a church and reach the people in that community the way God wants you to, you cannot do it all yourself. Letter F. They're comfortable with uncertainty. They're comfortable with uncertainty. In fact, I think great poet gardeners actually thrive on uncertainty. Now, let me unpack this just for a second. When you get done writing, just look up at me. Uncertainty does not connote bad leadership on your part. If people are feeling uncertain, that doesn't mean you're a bad leader. In fact, I think it means the need for leadership is very present. And this kind of leader doesn't get up and start putting on this front and say, everything's great, super, praise the Lord, hallelujah, bless God. They're not doing that stuff. They may get up and say, you know what, I don't know what we're doing next. We're sorting this through. Pray for, you know, that sort of thing. They're very authentic, but they're comfortable with this uncertainty. In fact, Andy Stanley, my accountability partner, says this very, very well. He says, this leader, this new next generation leader, this is really cool, understands that the need is for clarity more than anything else. People live with uncertainty every day of their lives, don't they? Monday through, some of them are uncertain about their job tomorrow. So uncertainty, in fact, when they get up, when a leader gets up in front and says everything's certain, they're saying, you're not being honest with me. They can read you like a book. But rather a leader that says, this is how much we know. Not this much, but only this much. But here's where we're going. And they issue an instruction that's very clear. Clarity is what people need. In fact, people will follow the leader who is clearest. You look at any environment, any organization. I'll tell you what, you go out of the playground where kids are playing at school. The leader who is the clearest is the kid who gets followed. Clarity. So they're comfortable with uncertainty. What they offer the people is great clarity. All right? Letter G. They listen and foster self-discovery. They listen and foster self-discovery. In other words, they're not just telling and telling and telling. They're teaching even with questions. By the way, didn't Jesus do this? Wasn't he the ultimate poet gardener? Didn't Jesus do a lot of his teaching with questions? In fact, they'd come to him with a question. He'd say, well, let me ask you a question. Is that true? One of the classics, in fact, I think I learned this principle right reading this text in the book of Luke. Remember the day that the scribes came to him and were trying to trap him? They said, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Remember that? And that was an unanswerable question. You couldn't answer that well. If he said yes, he was submitting to the lordship of Caesar. If he said no, he was violating the law of Rome and he could be thrown in prison. So they thought, we're going to trap him. So they said, should we pay taxes? And they kind of sit back waiting for this wrong answer. Remember what he does? He said, I got a question for you. Whose image is on the coin? Do you realize that Jesus was teaching a principle with that question? Because when they came back with the answer, Caesar's, he said, then render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but render unto God what's God's. Do you know what he's really teaching? He was teaching the principle that whatever object has an image stamped on it, that object belongs to the person whose image is stamped on it. The coin has Caesar's image on it. Give it to Caesar. You've been made in the image of God. You should be giving yourself to God. instead of asking me stupid questions about taxes. No wonder the next verse said, listen, no wonder the next verse says, and no one dared ask him any other questions. They got the principle. But listen, you know what he did? He did it with a question, didn't he? And so the poet Gardner is fostering self-discovery where light bulbs go on and they own it because they thought it. But you push them and poke them and prod them to get it. This is the day where telling doesn't go over well. But listen, asking questions goes over very well. And you can teach, I think, better with questions. Let's go to the next one. Letter H, they embrace the role of a mentor. They embrace the role of a mentor. Again, that doesn't mean you're the sage or the guru that has all the answers. But you're willing to enter a developmental relationship where you're saying, I'm going to give you what I've got. I don't have everything, but I've got this. Let me give this to you. This communication skill or this thinking skill or whatever it is you've got to offer. They're freely giving away the resources that they have. Letter I, less formal in structure. You may have noticed this. I know some of you are up in New England. It may not be super informal up there, but you know what I've noticed in churches pretty much across the country, pretty much across the world? Formality's going down, relationships going up. One last one I'm going to give you on this description here. Letter J. There we go. They're driven by service more than ego. Whereas the military commander or CEO or whatever might have just had a lot of ego involved, people, have you noticed people put up with less ego today than they did? I'm sure it's always been around and will continue. But in terms of style, they put up with less ego today. The next generation folks that I'm training all the time despise seeing arrogance up front. Arrogance is one of the worst sins in terms of in their thinking. Just to let you know, little tip off here. So this new kind of leader, it's really driven by this notion of, I just want to serve the community that I'm in, the city that I'm in. We want to reach it with the love of God and the grace of God. And they're honestly pushed by that desire to serve. And I tell you what, this leader is magnetic to people. Because I think there's a collective sense, even in pagans today, I want to make the world a better place. This millennial generation coming through is, I want to, you know, half the high schoolers today in America are involved in community service. Did you know that? And it's not youth groups, this is high public high schools. So there's a sense of, let's make the world a better place. And I believe the Christian leader ought to say, follow me. We'll do this together. A great example. I noticed up here in Virginia Beach, you all have Chick-fil-A restaurants up here. I love Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A is based in Atlanta, Georgia, where I live, and I get to the undeserved privilege of doing a lot of training with them from time to time. Dan Cathy is the president of Chick-fil-A now. His father, Truett Cathy, founded the restaurant chain and has passed it on to him. Dan Cathy, I believe, is a wonderful poet gardener, servant leader. They have collective meetings where they think together and so forth, and you watch service just fall all the way through the headquarters and down into the operators that that run restaurants. David Salyers is a vice president at Chick-fil-A. He told me, he said, Tim, recently I was on a trip with Dan Cathy. He said, we were up in Chicago, and he said, we roomed together in the hotel just to save some money, and as we were unpacking our luggage, I happened to make the comment, nonchalantly, I wish someone would invent shirts that don't wrinkle. My shirts keep getting wrinkled in my luggage. And then they went to bed. He said, David told me, he said, Tim, the next morning I woke up at 6. Dan, our president, had gotten up at 5 and was ironing all my shirts. President of the billion-dollar organization. Is there any wonder why servanthood just bleeds through the whole organization? I asked Dan about that recently. I didn't want to make him feel awkward, but I said, talk about that. And you know what he did? He smiled at me and said, Tim, you know what I've learned? The more you walk, the less you have to talk. That's a great statement. We're better at talking than walking, aren't we? So, through the years, the leadership style can be summarized this way. For the military commander, it was determining plans. For the CEO, it was doing programs. For the entrepreneur, it was designing products. For the coach, it was deploying players. You see how we're getting better and better, by the way, at this. But I think for the poet gardener, it's discerning purpose and developing people. Discerning purpose and developing people. Now, in the last few minutes I have, I want to camp out on some insights about this style. I just wish that we could, we'll take some time later on. I'd love to just talk about if you're seeing the same thing or if you're illustrating or you disagree or whatever, but I'm thinking this is what I'm seeing. As I got to thinking about this new kind of leader, I just came up with about a half a dozen insights that I think are great signposts for us that we can pretty much stake our leadership on, at least today, on this new kind of leader. If you don't mind, let me give you these six insights, and then we'll close. Insight number one. Our style often comes from the era when we learn to lead. Our style. In other words, the style you embrace, whether it's CEO or maybe you're still military commander. You say, if I got honest with you, I'd still kind of be a military commander. I'd like to run the church and let everybody pretty much follow my directions. I'd like to have my hands on everything. That's fine, but I'm going to guess that you learned that style back when, way back when. Probably didn't learn it today. And you just adopted it and you just held on to it. That's just kind of, when you learn to lead, that's what you've held on to. By the way, that's why military commanders still exist today in terms of different cultures, because they learned it somewhere and they just held on to that style. But you need to know that. Now listen, I believe there can be effective styles all across the board. I don't think you have to be a port gardener to be effective. I do believe you will expand your opportunity to be effective in this in today's world if you will shift and adapt to the style they're asking for. Let me give you a good example. In Atlanta, Georgia, where I live, there are many great, large, thriving churches. Atlanta's just a haven for big churches. Some of you may have heard of Dr. Charles Stanley. Charles Stanley is a great television minister, worldwide minister, great Bible teacher, great Southern First Baptist Church in Atlanta. Charles Stanley's wonderful. Charles Stanley's style is military commander. I mean, wonderful man, loves God, but man, you just salute him, and whatever he says, you just do it. Don't ask any questions. If you want to stick around, okay, you know? Now, his son, Andy Stanley, is pastoring church. I'm a part of North Point Community Church. Andy is a poet gardener. Now, get this. Andy used to work for his dad. And when he determined he was going to leave and plant a church and so forth, Andy and I meet for accountability. And Andy told me, he said, well, the first thing my dad said to me when I wanted to go out and plant a new church, my dad said, Andy, you're being disloyal. Sound like a military commander to you? You're being disloyal. See, that was what he valued, to stay in the church and take over the church one day as my son, you know, that sort of thing. Very normal. Now, which one's wrong? I'm not going to say which one's wrong. Both of them have good churches. But I do know this. In the 6 years that North Point has existed now, it's grown to about 14,000 adults, not to mention kids. And I believe it's because there's a culture of people that say, finally, here's a leader that doesn't get up and just try to be strong and domineering and so forth, but just says, let's take the journey together. Let's go together. Now, Andy's not a weak leader. He's a very strong leader, just a different style. Okay? Follow me on this? So just as you think about your own leadership style, I just want you to know, your style probably will come from the era when you learn to lead. For the person that you learn to lead from or the group of people or the time, it's probably going to reflect that. All right? Number two, the second insight is our willingness to adapt will impact our relevance. Our willingness to adapt will impact our relevance. Meaning, you may say, well, I kind of locked into this style, but I'm willing to push through and become others. I believe you will expand proportionately your ability to connect with people if you're willing to adapt as seasons demand it. Facts, I'm sure many of you have heard of Bill Hybels, the pastor of Willow Creek Community Church. They run, my goodness, I don't know, 15, 18,000 people outside of Chicago, Barrington, Illinois. Bill Hybels will talk about two particular seasons of his leadership journey where there were heavy, dark times. And at least one, if not both of those seasons, I think were connected to an adaptation he was making in his style. I mean, Bill Hybels started in the 70s reaching baby boomers. Baby boomers were the cutting-edge generation. Remember back in the 70s? That was, woo, 1 billion books were written on how to reach baby boomers. Some of us are baby boomers in this room today, aren't we? But then the Gen Xers came along. Oh, my gosh, what kind of breed are these people, you know? And then the millennials came along, and they've had to shift and adapt. I'm just saying, I bless him for at least his desire to say, I'm going to adapt because I want to keep reaching people, not say, well, I got a big church. If you like it, great. If you don't, go somewhere else. It'd be very easy to do with 15, 18,000 people, wouldn't you say? I've got my style. Thank you very much. We're pushing through. Listen, we should always be on the edge of learning, shouldn't we, leaders? We should always be pushing forward and saying, God, what do I need to do next? What's going to keep me stretching? What's going to keep me open? Not just locking in because you've got a somewhat successful ministry now. I tell you, when God first taught me this principle in my very first pastorate, I was a youth pastor for a while, and I'll never forget, I had a youth group and had just led a meeting Sunday night, gone back after the Sunday night meeting, and I turned on 2020. You all seen 2020? It's been on since Leviticus, I think. Anyway, 2020 was on. This is way back in the 80s now. 2020 was on, and this particular episode of 2020 They were interviewing all the members of the heavy metal band Kiss. Do you remember Kiss?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Got all their albums. Well, there they were, you know, with painted faces and so forth. And they were just boasting on this television program about all the money they were making, all the sex they were having, all the drugs they were doing. They're just having a great time boasting. And I was thinking to myself, all the kids in my youth group were thinking this was cute and cool. And I just got mad. In fact, I got so mad, I thought, I'm going to have to turn this TV off, or else I'm going to throw a brick through it. So I turned the TV off, and I just took a walk outside, and I said, Lord, somebody ought to do something about that. That is the wrong thing to pray, by the way, isn't it? You don't say that if you want to just stay inactive, okay? Because immediately the Spirit of God's poking me. How about you, buckwheat? You know, that's what he says to me. So I remember thinking, well, Lord, what do you want me to do? And are you like this too? When I asked, Lord, what do you want me to do? I immediately thought of all the safe options. And finally, after a few days, I finally said, all right, God, I'll make you a deal. And here's the deal I made. I said, Lord, if I'm ever in the same town at the same time as them, I'll go share Christ with them. Hallelujah, you know. Well, I thought that was a really safe option because I'm in Tulsa going to ORU, you know. And well, you know the rest of the story, I'm sure. They came to town the very next semester. In fact, one of my dorm mates came up and said, did you hear Kiss was coming to town? I said, oh, no. You know. He said, what? I said, Bob, this sounds crazy, but I think I'm supposed to go and share Jesus with all the members of Kiss. Of course, he thought I was wacko, you know. But to make a long story short, I did my homework on him. Student of the culture. Started looking at their backgrounds. I looked at the lyrics of their albums. Just did a lot of homework. And I thought, man. In fact, the big concern on my mind was, and the reason I'm telling this story is, I thought, how am I going to connect with these guys? They are from a fundamentally different world than I'm living in. And here I am, Pat Boone here with my, you know, suit on, you know. So I did a lot of homework, and I wanted to ask them questions. All the stuff that I didn't know what to call it yet, way back in the 80s, I thought, I've got to do this. I found out they were staying in the Camelot Inn. It's a big hotel in Tulsa, and I went over there, had my suit on. My suit was just lined with tracts and Bibles. I mean, I was bulletproof with tracts and Bibles. You could have shot me, poof, doesn't hurt. You just shoot again, it doesn't matter, you know. So I walked up to the front desk clerk, and I said, could you give me Gene Simmons' room, please? Like they're going to give it to me, you know. And she says, well, they've already checked in, but we're not allowed to give that information out. I thought, that's okay. At least they confirmed that they were there. So I start wandering on the lobby, just kind of wandering. And I remember asking myself, well, if I was a celebrity, what room would I be staying in? And I finally thought to myself, probably up in the big top floor, that big penthouse room in the top floor of the hotel. So I rode the elevator all the way up to the 7th floor, walked into this big room, and the maids were in the room, making up the beds and fluffing the pillows. Well, I just kind of played dumb, and I said, woo, this is a really nice room. I said, it's not hard for me to play dumb. I want you to know that. I said, this is a really nice room. I said, I bet all the celebrities stay in this room when they come to town, don't they? And one of the maids was so cute. She fluffing a pillow. She said, yes. She said, they always stay in this room. But she said, you know what's a funny thing? Kiss is in town tonight, and they're not in this room at all. They're right downstairs, room 628. I said, thank you very much, and I walk out the door. So I walk up to room 628, kind of knock on the door, you know, no one's there. So I just decide I'm just going to loiter around this area until they come. Well, I wait for 2 hours. And in that 2 hour period of time, I got to tell you, I was scared to death. You know, when you get into an arena where you know it's over your head, you just know it is. This is, you don't belong here. You're in, you know, minor single A baseball, and they're calling you up to the majors, and you're thinking, I'm not ready to hit this ball, you know. So all that time, I'm praying and praying and praying and thinking, how can I be relevant? How can I be relevant? The number one question was not what I was going to say, but how I was going to deliver it. By the way, passage of Scripture at the top of the notes, Colossians 4:6. You see what that passage says? Might be a good moment to just look back and read this. Paul the Apostle is writing, he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person. He didn't say, so you know what to say. You know what to say. So you should know how. Poet Gardner. Adapting. To make a long story short, I waited for 2 hours. I finally, wandering around the hallways, I look, and right in front of room 628, there is a man standing. He's not one of the members of the band, but he is a very, 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 very large man that they've hired to be their bouncer. And they have hired the right man. I want you to know that. This guy is just hanging out in front of the door. So I decided, well, I've got to go through him to get to them. So I've checked my tracks and my Bibles. I'm all set, you know, and kind of walked up, looked him right in the kneecap, and I said, sir, you know, how you doing? I said, my name is Tim Elmore. I'm a youth pastor here in town. You don't know me. I'm not a groupie. But I said, would you mind if I took a few minutes and just talk to Gene Simmons, Ace Frehley, Paul Stanley, and Peter Criss? Just a quick moment, please. You know. Well, he kind of grunts at me. He says, it's my job to keep people like you awake. I said, I know you could do a fine job of that right now, sir. But I said, if you won't let me talk to him, could I give you something? And I pulled out all my tracts and papers and Bibles. And here, I said, just let him, give this to him and have him read it. Well, this bouncer looks down at what I've got. And all of a sudden, he realizes. And he says, wow. Well, actually, he's had another word, but I'm going to say wow this morning. I'm going to keep this rated G right now. He said, well, he said, what you want to talk to him about is pretty serious, isn't it? I said, yes, it's very serious. He said, well, I'm not supposed to tell anybody this. But he said, I'll give this to him. He said, at 2:30 in the morning after their concerts, they usually go down to the bar for a little nightcap. If you want to join us at 2:30, I'll let you talk to him as long as you want to. I said, thank you very much. You know, and I ran down the hallway. Now I got another 2 hours on my hands. I'm walking and praying and so forth. But at 2:30 in the morning, on the dot, elevator doors open, and here they come in the lobby. They have the bouncer. Bouncer walks out first. Three women that have been in the hotel room with them. And then four of the ugliest men I've ever seen in all my life kind of saunter through the lobby. They got their makeup all scrubbed off, you know. And they walk into the bar. Well, the bar is completely empty. This is a God moment. Nobody's in there. No noise, no distractions. They all sit in a little circle. The bouncer's over standing off to the side. I walk up to the bouncer real quick just to get permission one more time because God told me to do this, but the bouncer's almost as big as God is. So I said, all right, all right. And so I walked up to these guys, and I mean to tell you, I took the poet Gardner approach. I said, you guys, how you doing? I said, hope your concert went well tonight. And I just asked them, I said, do you mind if I take a minute and talk to you about your influence? Yeah, it's fine, yeah, whatever, you know. And I said, do you ever stop and think about the kind of influence you have on the next generation and da-da-da? And they started chiming in and so forth. And then I said, do you ever think about God? And all of a sudden, Peter Criss chimed in and said, oh, are you the one that wrote all those papers? Get this. The bouncer had given them the tracks. They were up in the hotel room. Three out of the four had already read all the tracks. They're up in the hotel room with women reading my tracks. I like this. I really like this. So I said, yes. We start talking about building a relationship with Christ and so forth and so on, and talked about the return of Jesus. They all had their own theological theories that they had. I listened and so forth. And when we were done, I said, could I pray with you? And they said, fine. They bowed their heads. Hair flowed down as they bowed their heads. And we prayed together. And I prayed for them consistently since that time. 1 year later, Peter Criss quit the group. He had become a Christian. And I'm sure God had raised up many other people. Absolutely. I'm sure God had sprinkled many other people across the country, just nobodies like me that just gone in. But listen, you know what connects with poet gardeners? They would have listened to a military commander with the gospel. I had the gospel, but I was a poet gardener. Number three. The third insight I want to share with you is this. Our situation determines what style we must employ. Does that make sense? In other words, you don't just say, well, bless God, I'm a CEO or I'm a coach, whatever. You say, let me look at the situation, and that situation is going to help you learn the style. You've got the substance, you're just determining style. I'll give you a classic illustration. On September 11th, 2001, with a horrible tragedy that happened that day through terrorism, we didn't need George Bush to go up and form a little focus group on how we felt about terrorism. We needed a military commander, didn't we? Whether you agree with everything that's happened, we needed an action. We needed to say, this was not a moment for talking and talking. It was a moment where we need to take action. And so listen to me. You'll come into crisis situations where even though you've embraced poet Gardner as a style, you'll say, in this moment, we need to be a military commander. We need a coach. We need a CEO. So you've got to be reading the situation before you lead the situation. This is paramount. It's situational leadership, not situational ethics, situational leadership. Here's a great analogy. It came to my mind, and I think it's a good one. We're in the midst of a football season again, the Super Bowl coming up this weekend. I love college and pro football, and one of my favorite plays in college football is the option play. Y'all seen the option play before? Quarterback comes up to the line of scrimmage. He's getting ready to take the snap.
He gets the ball, and he starts running one direction. And you can tell it's the option play. What he's doing is he's running the direction. And what is he doing while he's running? He is sizing up the whole situation, isn't he? He's reading the defense. What are they doing? He's reading the talent next to him. Got a guy right here, got a guy right here. They're pretty fast, okay? He's reading the time on the clock. He's reading how many yards they need to get down the field to make first down, score a touchdown. He's reading five or six different things. And reading the situation, he determines, do I pitch it off? Do I keep it? Do I throw it downfield? Option play. That's what we're in right now. As leaders, we've got the ball. It's the gospel. We've got it. But it's option play. What do I need to do to get the ball downfield to score? I don't say, well, you know what? I really like this play. It's my favorite play. Isn't that what we do as pastors?
Oh, it's a great sermon.
Well, it's a great sermon. It's relevant for that moment. If it's not relevant, your best sermon may not be your best sermon for that moment. So it's the option play. I'll tell you what, in the pros, you know what we'll see this Sunday at the Super Bowl? We're going to see probably at some point a quarterback calling an audible. You know what an audible is, don't you? They go to the line of scrimmage, and they got a play in mind, but they're switching the last second. And an audible means they're verbally or audibly going to call out something different because they're reading the situation, and they decide we've got to lead differently. If our goal is to get to the end zone, I think we all agree that's the goal. By the way, we laugh at that, but sometimes do you wonder, is the church all agreeing on the goal here? Okay, enough said. Let's keep moving. Number four. The fourth insight is our style determines who we attract. That's a scary one. Do you realize if you just cling to one and say, well, bless God, this is who I am, you're going to eliminate perhaps the possibility of leading many, many people that you could have led. John Maxwell talks about the law of magnetism, doesn't he? From the law of magnetism, leaders attract who they are, not who they want. Darn it. Because we want a lot of other things. That, you know what? You'll tend to attract and the people will tend to be like you that you attract. Vision and values and passion and so forth and so on. So just know, as you make decisions on how I'm going to lead this machine here, your style is going to determine who you attract. Number five. The fifth insight is, in organizations, I believe your style must reflect the maturity of your followers. Okay? In organizations, your style must reflect the maturity of the followers. In other words, you may come into a ministry situation where they are wanting a poet gardener. They may not call it that, but they want a poet gardener. And you realize, listen, you're not ready for a poet gardener yet. You're not ready for me to completely share ownership. Do you follow what I'm saying? I need to get you to the place where you're ready for this kind of ownership and you're mature enough for it. You know what? This will help you get this. How many of you are parents in the room today? Okay, several of you? Okay. You know what I've noticed about parenting? You go through all five of these stations as you raise your kid. When they're infants and toddlers, they do not need a poet gardener. Well, would you like to touch that stove? I don't know. If you want to, just go ahead. We'll form a focus group and talk about touching hot stoves. That's not what you do. You say, don't touch that. Isn't that true? But as they grow older, if you're a good parent, you eventually at late teens are a poet gardener. You're sharing ownership. They're responsible now. You're making decisions together. They got the car keys. And if you've led it well, you've brought people to the place of poet gardenership. And that's what we ought to be doing with our churches. Maybe you came in and they needed a military commander, but you ought to move them along. If you're still a military commander years into your tenure, you're not doing something right. They should be maturing and leading this thing with you. Let's do one more. Number six. The last insight I'd share, and it's kind of a statement that goes without saying, is I believe this generation, and I don't just mean young people, the people living today, I think are asking, however they word it, for a poet gardener. Help me own this thing. Mentor me. I want to make a difference. I want to have a mission-driven life. I don't want to just do maintenance here. And by the way, this style of leadership works, as I've mentioned, in any number of contexts. If you're in corporate America, if you're in politics, if you're in the church, it works. In fact, my wife and I discovered that this works in our home. I just mentioned about the kid thing and leading him along the way. Our daughter, Bethany, is 15. And we're just wrestling with another issue this morning on her growing up and so forth and so on. When Bethany was 13, we started noticing as she emerged into her teenage years, she was wanting some more independence. You know how this happens to teenagers. And we just decided that probably this, we're going to a stage where while we've laid, a great foundation, our voices in her life were diminishing and the voices of others were expanding. And so we sat down with our daughter, Bethany, And I didn't say it this way or not, but I didn't say it this way, but I said, but I thought to myself, I'm going to need to lead as a poet gardener. And so we sat down with our daughter, and we said, Bethany, we want to come up with six women that you really admire and respect. Let's just come up with the names of six women. And I'm going to challenge them this 13th year of your life to be a part of your life this year as mentors, as one-day mentors. We thought of six ladies. She came up with names, and we both admired and respected them, Pam and I, my wife and I, and Bethany. And then I called these ladies up, and I just told them the exercise we were doing. I said, this is kind of like a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, but we don't really have a rite of passage in the American 21st century, so we're doing this. Well, they all agreed to it, every one of them. In fact, they took it beyond our wildest imaginations. One of the ladies named Sarah was a nurse, and when she heard that Bethany was thinking about becoming a nurse and maybe even working in the maternity ward, she took Bethany, this 13-year-old kid, into the maternity ward all day long. Bethany was watching and helping women give birth to babies all day, cutting umbilical cords and holding placentas, and she watched a C-section and natural birth. And I mean, I would have fainted 5 minutes into the day, you know. Bethany calls home halfway through the day, Mom, this is awesome. I was cut out for this. This is great. Got to the end of the afternoon. Sarah took her to a class for unwed mothers. She was teaching teenagers that were pregnant and probably shouldn't be. Bethany sat through that. And then at the end of the day, Sarah's life message with Bethany was on sexual purity. Well, don't you know she got that message much more clearly than had I shared a lecture on the subject. Bethany got home at the end of the day and said, oh, I know what I'm supposed to do with my life, and I know what my values are, and she just had a stake in the ground. Holly took her out next. Holly took her downtown Atlanta. They worked in the projects with homeless people all day. She got a heart for missions. End of the day, Bethany said, man, I got a heart for the, you know, just, that's great, Bethany, you know. Get this, Betsy took her out, another woman. She's a flight attendant. She surprised Bethany with a flight to New York City for the day. They spent the entire day ground zero and talked about making a difference in the world and, you know, charging hell with a water pistol and all that good stuff, you know, let's go. Bethany came home and, man, I just got a great... We have watched now the ramifications of those voices in her life. And get this, those ladies didn't necessarily say anything fundamentally different than what we would have said as parents, but it was another voice. We were just poet gardeners. We want to get to the end zone. At the end of the year, this was powerful. We brought all the six ladies together just to say thank you for their input in our daughter's life. And that night, Bethany sat him down in the living room and she read a card saying exactly what she had learned from them. And it was a thank you. Thank you for teaching me about this and that. And when it was done, I just read from Genesis about the blessing. And I couldn't even get to the end of the passage. Those ladies were gathering around Bethany and speaking into her life, talking about the potential they saw in her. Don't forget what I told you. Laid hands on her, prayed over. It was wonderful. We had three boxes of Kleenex in the room that night, but it was just powerful. And when Pam and I went to bed, we thought, thank you, Lord, that we didn't just say, well, bless God, we're her parents. You know, would that just not be stupid? You know what? There's a moment you got to realize this is just me. This is power trip. This is positional power, not personal power. And it won't work anymore. Let me close this way. As I think through this idea of being a poet gardener, I'm thinking to myself, even though I've already suggested it, Jesus was the ultimate poet gardener. You look at those later, at those 10 characteristics. Brilliant. Walked into people's lives, served, wasn't about ego, I think we're safe in saying, met their needs, listened, asked questions, fostered self-discovery, coached them along the way. He leads more people today than any other person in the history of mankind. I think he was onto the right idea. Enough said. Let's pray.
Sociologists tell us that the most introverted of people will influence over 10,000 others in their lifetime. Here at Growing Leaders, we want you to make this influence as life-changing as possible. For more audio and printed resources, look us up on the web at www.growingleaders.com or give us a call at area code 770-495-3332. And until next time, remember, leadership development is a process, not just an event.